from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start this week with our monthly tour of recent science headlines, compliments of our friends at Nature News. Benjamin Thompson joins me now from their London offices. Benjamin, good to talk with you again.
Heather, it's an absolute pleasure.
We're going to focus on just two stories this time around, two biggies. The first is the discovery of the most complete or the largest fossil yet of an ancient human from a group known as the Denisovans. Before we talk about this new fossil, who even was that group? I mean, we all seem to be familiar with Neanderthals, but this is a different group.
Yes, the Denisovans are a group of hominins, and they're quite mysterious. Now, they say they're an ancient group, a sister group, if you will, to the Neanderthals, and they split off from sort of lineage to humans, as I understand it, about half a million years ago.
That's a long time ago.
Oh, absolutely. And the reason they're so mysterious is that, there's been very sort of little evidence of their existence. And now their name comes from a cave in Siberia, where some teeth and some shards of bones were discovered about a decade ago, give or take. And these were identified as being this new group of hominins, the Denisovans.
So what is this new find?
Yes, so this answers a lot of questions that ancient anthropologists and researchers have been asking and looking for answers for. And this finding was from a cave in the Tibetan Plateau, which is obviously thousands and thousands of miles away from Russia, where the first cave was. And this is a jawbone and a couple of teeth. These have turned out to be more remains from the Denisovans.
I have to say that some of the headlines this past week, the most complete or the largest fossil yet, and then you find out, it's just the jawbone, but even that is more than we had before. And as you said, answers some intriguing questions, some of which has to do with adaptation to living at higher altitudes, because not only is this Tibetan cave thousands of miles away from the original cave in Siberia, it's also quite a bit higher in elevation, right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Sort of 3,000 meters above sea level, I believe, which is, as you say, much higher than the original cave. Now, Denisovan DNA has been found in modern humans in Asia and Oceania for a while, right? And it was expected that sort of the remains of these Denisovans would be found more widely. If there's evidence in human DNA, they should have been found all over the place. And that's what this finding has allowed now. This finding in the Tibetan Plateau has showed that they were in other places that weren't just Siberia. And these Denisovans had a gene variant that helped them live at high altitudes, okay? Something that I think was believed to have developed a little bit later on from when they were believed to have sort of split off on the timeline. Now, some modern Tibetans have this gene variant, and that helps them live at high altitudes. And so nobody could really square the circle of where this variant came from until now that Denisovans have been found in that location.
In addition to, opening up the realm of possibilities about where Denisovans lived and maybe answering or providing some clues to follow up on, at least with regard to the ancestry of that gene variant in Tibetans, this find and this analysis of the fossil seems to open up a realm of new possibilities just in how fossils are even analyzed and how the relationships between different fossils are analyzed. That also has made it a little bit controversial. So what did they do differently in this case?
Yes, this is quite fascinating, and it seems like it could be a really important development. So typically when we're analyzing sort of ancient remains, you're looking for DNA, right? That's the gold standard for comparing and contrasting, species and remains to see whereabouts on the timeline and what species they've come from. Now, the problem with DNA, and particularly ancient DNA, is that often it can get degraded by, humidity or just time or what have you. But in this case, the team have used protein remains to try and work out where these Denisovans, were they Denisovans in the first instance, to be honest with you. Now, DNA and proteins have been used together in the past, but this is the first time it's been a solely sort of protein-based solution. And what the research team did is they looked at a collagen protein in the teeth of these remains, and that sort of lasted for these thousands of years. And they compared these proteins to other Denisovan proteins and that found in Neanderthals and what have you. And this is how they've managed to come up with this lineage and the belief proof that these were Denisovans.
Well, we need to move on to the other story this week, which is unfortunately not nearly as much fun. And it's a rather dire report from the UN, actually a preview of a full report that will come out later this year about the role that humans are playing in the widespread extinction of other species on the planet. Can you just give us the upshot of this report?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sort of sugarcoat this one. Up to 1 million plant and animal species face extinction, and many of those within decades because of human activities. So we're not talking, you know, far-flung future. We're talking the here and now.
And what are the causes that specifically they pinpoint, I think, five different human activities that are the main drivers of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the reports or what this sort of preview of the report says is that more than 75% of sort of land areas and more than 66% of oceans have been significantly altered by people. Now, much of this has been caused by agricultural activities, you know, crop and livestock operations. They co-opt apparently more than 33% of the Earth's land and 75% of freshwater resources. So agriculture then is a big driver of these fears. And other threats to nature are through the exploitation of things like, you know, logging or harvesting and fishing, and other things were the spread of invasive species and, of course, climate change.
Is this an inevitable end at this point? I mean, the headline is pretty dire, but what does this report say about whether this is a preventable outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sense that I get from this is without sort of transformative changes to, you know, economic, social, political systems and policies, I mean, the people behind this report, and to give them their full name, is the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or the IPBES. I think they suggest that major losses to biodiversity will continue into 2050 and beyond. So, I mean, it really isn't a good news story, this one.
And they do highlight that this isn't just a problem for the plants and animals that are going extinct. It isn't just a problem for those who care about nature or consider themselves environmentalists, that this is a problem for humans and for our societies, right?
Yes. And it really does add grist to the mill that governments need to take action and they need to do it soon. So this really is an agenda-setting report.
Well, Benjamin, not a happy note to end on, but we do thank you. That's Benjamin Thompson. He's a multimedia editor with Nature's podcast and video team. Benjamin, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to follow up on that rather dire UN report now with the story of one group's efforts to stem the tide of extinction, not by restoring habitat or cutting climate emissions, but by banking genetic material. Back in the 1970s, a researcher at San Diego Zoo started freezing and storing samples of tissues and cells from endangered species. That project continues today. It's known formally as the Institute for Conservation Research, but less formally as the Frozen Zoo. Oliver Ryder is the director of conservation genetics there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This strikes me as a modern day effort similar to Noah's Ark. Instead of trying to gather two of every species, you're trying to gather tissue or cell samples, genetic material from endangered species. Is that kind of how you view this effort?
The concept is correct. Noah saved allegedly, you know, a pair of each animals, and we know that we wouldn't be able to restore populations from two by twos. But the idea of bridging between the present and the future at a time when species are going to decline, that's very much in line with the biblical story.
And why wouldn't just two of any given species be enough to restore that species?
Because they would very quickly become inbred.
Ah, so what exactly is it that you're storing at the Frozen Zoo at this point?
Well, we store reproductive material. We store gametes, so semen samples, sperm, and reproductive tissues from which ova or eggs can be matured. And we also save skin cells, viable cells from the body, and those can be, a small biopsy can be taken, those can be grown in the laboratory, and then frozen, and then thawed, and grown again. And this process can be undertaken multiple times, so it's a very expandable resource that's been used historically for a wide variety of scientific studies that have advanced our knowledge about species, which is something we need to do because it's typical that endangered species we know the least about, especially about their genetics.
And presumably, since two would not be enough to restore a population, you've got samples from multiple individuals of any given species?
Well, that's our aspiration, and there are many species that we have multiple individuals from. There are some species that come from very small starting populations that came to zoos when only a handful of animals started. What we try to do is capture the gene pool that we can readily access. And as we think about the declining state of biodiversity, we realize that it's more and more important to try to broaden these collections so they become conservation collections. So we could use them to restore populations and or rescue populations that survive but have become, critically small, not likely to make it because of these effects of small population size that include inbreeding.
Oliver Ryder, take us back to the 1970s when this project started. Obviously, we didn't have the technology at that point to clone an animal. What was the original thought about how these cell and tissue samples would be used to help endangered species?
Well, initially, we wanted to show that this was a worthwhile effort and that that could be easily done by conducting studies on the chromosomes of animals. Different animal species have different numbers of chromosomes. And even today, the chromosome number of only about half of the mammals is known. The chromosome number of humans is 46. The chromosome number of gorillas is 48. Chromosome numbers in mammals vary from 6 to over 100. One of the concerns about having sustainable populations and breeding is making sure that compatible animals are bred. And it's the case that there are multiple species in nature that we don't distinguish as different. But in fact, if they are the individuals from those populations are interbred, they're reproductive problems because their chromosomes are different. So we were tackling that problem. That was the genesis of the effort. But there was always the recognition that we were banking something that would have uses beyond our current imagination. The founder of the frozen zoo, Kurt Benerschke, had a poster with a quote from the Librarian of Congress that said, "We've got to save things for reasons we don't understand." And we could imagine that there were going to be rapid developments in biological sciences that could take advantage of the access to the unique set of samples that we were banking. And of course, that turned out to be wildly true.
Of course, technology has advanced a lot, which would expand the options both of the kinds of research you can do and the kinds of applications, conservation and restoration applications that this frozen zoo could be used for. So what are some of the types of research that have been done?
Well, the frozen zoo has contributed samples that have reformulated our knowledge about the evolutionary relationships of mammals. It wasn't appreciated in 1970 that elephants and aardvarks and golden moles were all close relatives to each other on the evolutionary tree of mammals. So understanding the tree of life has been greatly aided by samples from the frozen zoo. Now we're in the genomics era, and the frozen zoo is proving to be a crucial resource for advancing our knowledge of evolution and the differences between species. You know, if you will, why a zebra has stripes and all manner of questions about the diversity of animal life. And now, even beyond that, we can think about using these cells for genetic rescue. We are turning cells from the frozen zoo into stem cells, cells that can make any cell in the body that we intend to find out possible to use for producing eggs and sperm that could be used for making embryos, that could have cells from the frozen zoo have babies, literally.
And so is the idea there to bring extinct species back using that technology?
No, I think our emphasis is to try to have species, to keep species from going extinct. It's only been in the last 60 years that it's been possible to save cells from animals and then freeze them and then thaw them so that they're viable and can resume their function. So, you know, without cells, it's going to be very difficult to do de-extinction efforts, we think. But with cells, there's the possibility of actually restoring the gene pool of a species back to a level that it was when the samples were collected.
So introducing more genetic diversity into a very small and threatened population.
Yes, restoring genetic diversity that was lost, you know, would increase the number of options for the future. It's not that we don't think that habitat conservation or stopping illegal poaching and wildlife trafficking isn't crucially important, but we feel the future will be best served by providing an elaborated array of options. And in that way, there will be more biodiversity left for the future than if we rely on any single strategy.
Oliver Ryder, a new UN report out in the past week says that 1 million species are at risk of extinction, many of those just in a matter of decades. Why put efforts specifically into banking cells and genetic material, this approach, as opposed to trying to address some of the underlying causes that new report highlights, things like habitat destruction or climate change or pollution?
Well, I'm the first person to say all of those issues need to be tackled and every effort applied. But during my career, I've watched species go extinct. And I think that we serve the overall goal of enhancing the prospects for our descendants by providing the widest possible set of options. In terms of banking, there's no time we're going to be able to collect more biodiversity than now because it's declining. So I think if we were to have a kind of a conversation with the future, they would tell us, you know, biodiversity is declining, you know, just bank as much of it as you can because we would be glad to have it.
And how much have we banked so far?
Well, we've been working at it for 40 years at the San Diego Zoo Institute for Conservation Research, and we have frozen semen gametes from 1,000 animals. We have tissue culture cells, frozen cells from 10,000 individual vertebrate animals. It represents over 1,100 species, which people say, wow, that's amazing. But it's a very small part of biodiversity that's at risk. There's a great need to expand these efforts around the globe in regional centers and within countries to utilize the technology for viable cryobanking of living cells and tissues to stem the tide. And it will be useful in ways that people don't now even imagine.
I mean, 10,000 individual samples, about 1,000 species. Obviously, they're not going to be perfectly distributed this way. But if you just kind of, you know, average things out, that's about 10 individuals per species. You said 2 isn't enough to save a species. Is 10? I mean, what kind of numbers do you need to get to actually make this a really strong tool for saving endangered species?
Well, that's a very important question, and one that's been tackled that confronted the field of conservation biology 30 years ago and up until the present, because species vary. We don't know precisely the answer for any species. So estimates are made. So it may be 10 or 20 individuals per species. But now with sequencing genomes, we can actually assess the genetic load of species, assess their inbreeding. So I think we can foresee a time when we will be able to more empirically analyze the risk factors for populations. And we're only going to be able to do those risk assessments if we bank the material.
And yet, again, 1,000 species out of the million or more that are at risk of extinction in coming decades. Are there efforts to expand beyond your frozen zoo to more frozen zoos and be able to scale up to anything close to what the threat actually is to biodiversity?
Well, that's one of our urgent priorities. that's what I was working on yesterday and what I will work on tomorrow.
Oliver Ryder is the Director of Conservation Genetics at San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research, informally known as the Frozen Zoo. Oliver, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Up next, a citizen science initiative that finds most of the seafood caught in New England is hard to buy in New England, and that could have ecological consequences. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Dozens of species of fish and shellfish are caught in New England's waters, but only a handful show up in most seafood retailers. You can probably list them: cod, haddock, scallops, clams, lobster. Well, now it's not just anecdotal. A citizen science initiative has found that those five species dominate at New England seafood counters, and that some of the species that are actually the most common out in the ocean are the rarest in our markets. That's largely a reflection of our food tastes, but it can have ecological as well as economic ramifications. So Eating with the Ecosystem, the group that ran the Citizen Science Project, has also released a cookbook to help us enjoy a greater diversity of seafood. It's called Simmering the Sea, Diversifying Cookery to Sustain Our Fisheries. Kate Masery is Program Director for Eating with the Ecosystem and the coordinator of the Eat Like a Fish Research Project. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Kate, we all have a sense of this just from going to the store, but why did you think it was really important to put numbers to this mismatch between what's in the ocean and what's in our seafood markets?
Well, yeah, as consumers, we've all been to a fish market before or to a grocery store and seen kind of what species are available in the marketplace. But for us at Eating with the Ecosystem, we're a very science-based organization. We care about the data. And so for us, it was important to actually collect information to make sure that just what our assumptions were correct. And then to collect information on how to kind of work towards a better match between what's actually produced in our waters and what's actually in our marketplace.
So how did you go about collecting that data?
So we enrolled 86 citizen scientists in our Eat Like a Fish Citizen Science Project. And so these were just normal people from all over New England, all the coastal states, I should say. And their job was to look at the availability of 52 different New England species in the marketplace. And so each week they received a fish list, which was four randomly generated fish out of 52 possible species. And everybody's fish list was different each week. And they were sent to up to three markets looking for their fish.
Are we talking about dedicated seafood markets or just the grocery store? Only fresh fish, also frozen? I mean, what were the constraints there?
So they were allowed to look at any type of market that sold fish. So it could be a regular grocery store. It could be a specific fish market. It could be some direct sales in some case, directly from fishermen or community-supported fisheries, that kind of thing. Or it could be kind of a small mom-and-pop shop that, you know, had some seafood. And so literally any place that sold seafood, they were allowed to shop at. And it could include frozen as well as fresh.
So we've already mentioned the five species that were found most commonly: cod, haddock, softshell clams, scallops, and lobsters.
Yes.
What were the ones that are found in New England's waters, fished in New England, but you almost never saw in a fish market?
We had 52 species included in the study, and the five that you mentioned, those were the top five that were found more than 50% of the time. But the rest of the species, 47 species, were found less than 50% of the time, and 30 of those species were found less than 10% of the time. So it was a number of species, but some examples include...
I won't make you list all 30.
Yeah, some examples include dogfish or scup, whiting, butterfish, mahi-mahi, red hake, a lot of our flounders, Acadian redfish. The list kind of goes on.
Wow. I want to bring in another voice here. Michael Fogarty is a senior scientist at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center with the Ecosystem Research Program. Mike, from a science perspective and an ecosystem perspective, is this a problem, this mismatch between what's in the ocean, what's being caught, and what's being sold locally?
Well, I think it's really an important advantage of selling it locally and also having a broader diversity of species represented in the marketplace provides more security for both fishers, and it's likely, if done properly, to have lesser impact on the ecosystem as a whole rather than highly selective removals of just certain species, which we've typically had in the past. So just as a financial advisor would tell you to maintain a diverse portfolio, I think what's really important about Kate's work is this idea of actually trying to make that a reality in the seafood markets.
Mike, there's been a big push really in recent years towards something called ecosystem-based management, trying to manage our fisheries not just as disconnected species, but as a whole ecosystem. How different is that in a nuts and bolts sense from traditional management? I mean, in the end, don't you still need to have limits for each individual species? How different does it look?
There are three principal elements that differ. One is that we're taking a place-based approach. So we'll have management plans for defined ecological regions. So, for example, most people who are listening will be aware of George's Bank as an important fishing ground. It also has some very distinct ecological properties that mean it's an appropriate unit for us to consider for a separate management plan. The second part is that we're going to look at interrelationships among the species. Who eats whom? What are the potential competitors? And also their relationship to the environment. And because we're in a rapidly changing climatic environment, that becomes very important. And the third part that's different than conventional management, and this is the part that really links to what Kate and her colleagues are doing, is that we want to bring in humans as an integral part of the ecosystem, not something apart. And so this is really essentially trying to close that loop and making sure that we connect with the ecosystem in very realistic ways.
So let's take a single species as an example. And I know the point is that we're not supposed to just be eating one species all the time. We should be diversifying. But pick one of those species that is commonly caught in New England that's probably the stock is in good shape. There's enough there to have a sustainable fishery, but that we almost never see in the fish market, and maybe we need more of a market for.
Mm-hmm. Well, spiny dogfish is one that comes to mind. Now, we do have some local fisheries. In fact, there's a niche market that's developed for some of our Chatham fishermen who capture spiny dogfish and also skates and have markets for them. Basically, in that case, it's a fish that's underutilized, and a very large fraction of the catch of spiny dogfish, which is quite common in the nets of fishermen, particularly trawl fishermen, is discarded. So we really can develop imbalances in an ecosystem for that reason. So what we'd like to do is to, again, have a more diversified portfolio, including species like spiny dogfish, and take from a broader spectrum of species, but less from each, so that we do less harm to the overall ecological structure.
Kate Masri, then if we shift over to the cookbook, Simmering the Sea, spiny dogfish is in there, right?
It
Can
is.
You give us an example? Because a lot of us have never encountered spiny dogfish in a food setting, right? What
yeah.
would we do with it?
So spiny dogfish is actually very popular as fish and chips over in Europe. And so if you've been over to England and ordered fish and chips, most likely you've actually eaten spiny dogfish and not even realized it. And so the recipe that we have in Simmering the Sea is also for a fish and chips style dogfish. It's actually very meaty. It's a white meat, but mild flavor. So a lot of people who have it fried can't really tell the difference between that and cod.
If you had to pick another favorite recipe from the cookbook, something that people might not have encountered before, what would it be?
I have a lot of favorites, but we have a recipe for slipper limpets in the cookbook, which I'm pretty sure most of us have never encountered before. And so we have a Manhattan-style chowder recipe that uses slipper limpets.
And instead of clams.
Instead of clams, yeah. And you could add clams in there with it if you wanted to. One of the nice things about all of these recipes is that, you know, you can add a lot of different species to them and kind of subs fish out depending on what you have available. We actually have suggestions at the bottom of each recipe for alternative species that you could use. But slipper limpets is kind of a fun one that most people didn't realize you could even eat.
I was, you know, thinking we were going to go the direction of escargot or something with that.
We do have a periwinkle recipe in there as well.
Wow. Okay. So this definitely is diverse. Mike Fogarty, I want to go back to your description of what a more ecosystem-based approach to fishing might look like. It was almost like you were describing kind of skimming off the top of the entire ecosystem, that you'd want to take a little bit of everything out. Is that kind mm-hmm. of the goal?
Well, among the options that we're looking at is to have target levels of catch aimed at groups of species rather than individual species, but still maintain the protection. So we're continuing to monitor the individual species. And if we begin to see signs of trouble in any of them, then we could put the appropriate safeguards in place to avoid a sharp decline. This is more consistent with the way the fish are caught, to think about them as being caught together.
Right. I mean, if you put a net down there, it's hard to say net only catch cod today.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, it's impossible. Although fishermen are very good naturalists and keen observers of nature, but they just can't simply exactly target any of the species. And one of the difficulties we encounter with current management is that it's effectively assumed that they can. And so target levels that are taken for individual species or set for individual species very often cannot be met exactly because of this problem we're just talking about. And so they either overshoot or undershoot the mark. And that's, from an economic point of view, of course, not optimal. So we're looking for ways to really take that directly into account. And also the fact that as predator-prey relationships affect the overall catches, that what we do to one species is going to affect others. And right now, we don't take that into account. So we could have management plans that are really working at cross purposes unless we do a better job of looking at this as not a collection of parts, but an integrated whole.
So how close or far are we from getting to this point you're describing of a more ecosystem-based management system here in New England?
In New England, we've been working very closely with the New England Fishery Management Council to develop what's called a fishery ecosystem plan. And we're aiming to put a draft document before the council in the fall.
Kate Masry, where do you see the work that you're doing at Eating with the Ecosystem fitting into this attempt to transition to a more ecosystem-based management system? What is it you're hoping will come out of things like this citizen science study that shows us what's actually in our fish markets?
So Eating with the Ecosystem kind of sees itself as the market component to ecosystem-based management. And so Mike used language like place-based, and that's the same language that we use as well when we're talking to consumers about eating a wider diversity of species kind of in proportion to their natural abundances and making sure that we're adapting our diets with ecosystem changes and supporting our fishing communities and taking care of the habitats and all of that.
It seems almost like an extension of the very popular local food movement.
Exactly.
But we're not as, you know, local food typically comes from a farm, right? Not from a wild ecosystem. And these ocean ecosystems are somewhat unfamiliar to most of us. I mean, they're out there underwater off the coast.
They are, yeah. So they're very complex. So in an ideal world, you know, if 5% of the ocean consisted of black sea bass, then 5% of our diets would consist of black sea bass. And if 10% of the ocean consisted of monkfish, 10% of our diets would consist of monkfish. But to know that in real time in those exact proportions is very, very difficult. And so for us, to teach consumers just there is this wide diversity of species, and if you kind of diversify your diet and be less selective, be more adaptable in what you eat kind of all of these species, but, you know, in smaller amounts and kind of spread it out throughout all of these species, then we can kind of really have minimal impacts on our marine food webs and maintain more of a natural balance.
At the same time, given the data that you've just generated, eating more diversely, eating a broader range of seafood species is not necessarily easy because they're not easy to find in the retail market. So it is part of the goal here to try to make a shift there. And how do consumers start to put some pressure and push in this direction?
Yeah, one of the goals definitely is to make a shift to try to see more representation for some of these species that were underrepresented in our marketplace. And so I think our citizen scientists actually did a great job in leading the way in terms of what any consumer can do. They asked for these species. Each time they went to the market, they asked for some of these local species. And they received, you know, generally very positive feedback back from the fish markets themselves. The fish markets were like, oh, no one ever asked for that. We can get that for you. In some cases, they're like, you know, we don't have it, but we have this other really similar species.
Yeah.
So Heather, another avenue for this is that there is an evolving movement towards community-supported fisheries, just as there is for agriculture. And in those systems, as you know, people are encouraged to try different things along with some of the mainstays in their diet. So it's another vehicle that could help this movement to making these less commonly marketed foods more familiar to folks.
And it can certainly make life a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Well, the cookbook is Simmering the Sea, Diversifying Cookery to Sustain Our Fisheries. Kate Masry is the Program Director for Eating with the Ecosystem. And Michael Fogarty is a Senior Scientist at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, Heather.
Up next, everyday chaos and how machine learning can help us make sense of it. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We all know that the internet and artificial intelligence are changing the way we live. We fret about how distracted we've become or about whether robots will take our jobs. And those are real concerns. But my next guest says that computing technology is, or at least should be, forcing a much deeper introspection and transformation in the ways that we seek to understand the world around us and predict what's to come. David Weinberger's newest book out this month is Everyday Chaos. He's previously the author of The Clue Train Manifesto, and he's a senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather.
Multiple physicists over the years have said to me that all of science is based essentially on a leap of faith, on an assumption that there are discoverable laws and constants that govern the universe and that we can understand them, you know, given sufficient technology. Your underlying idea seems to be that, in fact, the world is so complex that we will never be able to understand it, and maybe we shouldn't even bother. Does that not disturb you at all?
Well, when you put it like that, yeah, completely. I'm frightened. So you jumped immediately to the hardest point for me. And I think I'm not capable, and I'm not sure that we are capable of resolving it. I certainly do not want to be in the position of denying science. That's an easy starting point. Or the sorts of laws that science has discovered over the centuries. I'm not about to pick an argument with Newton. You know, that would just be foolish. So at the very least, I think that machine learning in particular is teaching us that the fundamental covenant, which you just referred to, is not as solid as we had hoped. The new thing about machine learning is that you feed it in the data. You don't tell it how you, the human, think this data should go together, what the general principles and rules and laws are. And instead, it just iterates on this massive amount of data, and it finds correlations, and those correlations can be extremely detailed. And building a neural network, a model that is so complex that at least in some instances, we literally cannot understand how the machine outputs its results, what the processes were. And that presents a model of models where there may not be generalizations, at least of the sort that we recognize, just millions of particulars.
So give us an example of where, I mean, we can all think of examples of having enormous amounts of data that we would want to make sense of. But give us an example of machine learning being able to better or in a more useful way, I guess, make sense of that. And in particular, with this last point that you were making, that it's not necessarily generalizable, that it's not trying to get to principles. It's just trying to get to one specific answer for one specific question.
Any of the applications of deep learning, which is a type of machine learning, are likely to meet those criteria. So there are examples in diagnostic software where patient records, hundreds of thousands of patient records, in one instance with 500 data points on average for each of those records, have been fed into a system without any instruction to the system about even that, you know, This is data about medications. This is data about symptoms and results. And now connect them. You don't even tell them that. You just give it these big piles of numbers. And some of these systems can predict the onset of diseases more accurately than humans can. And in some instances can predict the onset of diseases that humans simply cannot predict. It turns out that from retinal scans now, machine learning is able to offer up information about heart health and also about age and gender and other stuff that we didn't know was encoded in retinal scans. And both computer scientists and scientists, you know, heart scientists have have looked at these scans and tried to figure out what about them tells the computer what somebody's cholesterol level is or what the gender is. And at least so far, we can't figure it out. And yet there is some promise that maybe at some point we'll be able to just have our retina scan and get a readout of our heart health.
Those are all very promising. But to say that deep learning or machine learning builds a model of the world independent of humans is not strictly speaking true, because humans are still feeding it data. And we have learned more and more as these algorithms have cropped up in more and different parts of our lives that what data gets used to train a learning algorithm can be critically important. And to your example about trying to diagnose patients, if the patients that are in that system only represent certain ethnicities or only a certain limited part of the genetic variety of the human race, then in fact the predictions that might come out of that could be horribly skewed. And we also see that in the criminal justice system with sentencing algorithms that try to predict who might be a flight risk or who might be at risk of becoming a repeat offender. And those algorithms end up reflecting and amplifying the inherent racism in our criminal justice system. So can we really afford to trust machine learning without understanding how it's getting from A to B?
100% right, and hugely important. Hold off for the moment on the hugely important question of whether we want to use them. It is absolutely right that humans are not independent of these systems. We are placing the sensors around the world, gathering the data that matters to us for one reason or another. That is a social activity. And what we choose to gather is deeply embedded in the set of beliefs that we have about what things affect others. I mentioned a diagnostic system that worked off of patient records. These, just as you're saying, these patients were all within, or generally within, one area of New York, and that has enormous socioeconomic, gender, racial implications. Even regardless of that hugely important fact, it was based off of hospital records. That's already a decision by humans about what sort of data we think matters to health.
Right.
Right? And that, I think, is inevitable, because information is not a natural artifact. It's something that we create that has very consequential effects. Nevertheless, the model of models that AI gives us is, I think, very unlike the model of models that we've been using in order to understand our world.
David Weinberger, in Everyday Chaos, it's largely a forward-looking book, but you also trace the history of how we got here. And it was really interesting to me, living in a society which you describe as being somewhat obsessed with prediction. You know, we want to know what the weather is going to be like in an hour, in a day, in a week, so that we can plan for that. We want to know what the economy is going to do. We want to know what's going to happen with elections and all sorts of other things. And you say that hasn't always been the case. And you go back actually to ancient Egypt and ancient Greece and say these were, you know, very advanced intellectual societies that weren't really based around or that concerned with prediction. And that to me seems fundamentally kind of foreign, hard to even imagine.
Well, that's because it's foreign and hard to imagine. You know, that's how history works, right? I mean, it's so in ancient Egypt, there was not a lot of change. It was a cyclical environment. The Nile overflowed pretty predictably, so in our terms, pretty predictably with the seasons, which were marked by astronomical events, you know, the appearance of the dog star or whatever it was. There was not – the conditions for what we recognize as predictions are things like a sense that there are things that we can know that let us predict what will happen, to see what will happen. But enough variation and enough randomness in those predictions that we can talk about this thing that we call a prediction.
Len David Weinberger, what is, in your mind, the take home? I mean, I understand that it's completely ironic to ask you after this conversation to predict the future. But What relationship do you see emerging between human pursuits of knowledge, our societal desire for predictability or some understanding of what's likely to happen in the future, and these new technologies like artificial intelligence, machine learning, that understand or at least make sense of the world in a fundamentally different way?
The premise of my book is, in some ways, if we assume that technology, our tools, have tended to shape our understanding of ourselves and especially our minds. And historically, I think that's the case. If that's the case, then also assume that machine learning is going to be a dominant technology, which I think it is well headed towards. Then how might that change how we think about who we are and what our position in the world is, which is, I understand, is a very big question, and I don't pretend to have anything like a full or even adequate answer to that question. But that's basically the question of the book.
It is. And that's the question that's on many people's minds and I think spurs these very deep fears of a robot takeover, that our place in the world will be supplanted by intelligent machines.
Yeah, I know that's I think that's a good fear to have. But I view it as, If we were to say, which is, I think is only a bit of an exaggeration, that we are currently going through a moral panic about AI, from my point of view, much of that's real and we need to be dealing with for sure. But I think part of it is also based in a metaphysical panic that AI's model, the machine learning model of models, its way of thinking about how the world goes together, so far surpasses, is so different from and surpasses our ability to put pieces together. We've had to use generalizations in order to make sense of the chaos. And we've obviously, as a species, we've done a pretty good job at that. Machine learning does not rely upon those generalizations. It's piece to piece in a gigantic net in which everything happens all at once and everything affects everything else. That seems to me to be a more true picture of how the world works. Now we have a tool in machine learning that enables us to make some predictions and to do a bunch of things faster than we could before, sometimes incredibly much faster. We use it because it works. That model of models, I think, I'm actually a little more hopeful than I think many people are, because I think that model of models serves some salutary purposes. First of all, as I say, I think it is a more accurate depiction of how the world works. I think, second of all, it's probabilistic. It's humbling. And if we start to learn from this that all that we see and believe should be, we should be gauging in terms of it's how certain we are and make that part of the discourse, then we maybe can advance beyond sort of in the sense of maturity about who we are in the world. If we can learn from this experience with machine learning that explanations are tools, they are incredibly useful tools. They're not the only tools that we use in order to control systems and to get what we want from them, even pre-AI even. If we can learn that explanations are tools and that understanding is a tool as well, then I think we start to gain some of the humility and perspective that is more reflective of our tiny position in an overwhelming world. If it helps us to see more of the world, what we've written off as accidental or because we don't see exactly how it fits or the data is beyond our capacity, if we start to see the world more for what it is, then I think we are at a really important and exciting inflection point in our history.
David Weinberger's new book is Everyday Chaos. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.